Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will have time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If any of you require assistance during the workshop, please press star and zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, Living with Chronic Myelogenous Leukemia, or CML. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between many other cancer organizations and blood cancer organizations, and I particularly would like to mention the National CML Society, which is a wonderful resource for all of you on the call today, and there are many other organizations that are resources for all of you as well. Now, on today's program, we have over 623 participants, so there's a lot of you on the call from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Canada, China, Ireland, Morocco, Serbia, and the United Kingdom, so you really come from all over the world, and it really is a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by Ariad Pharmaceuticals, Inc. and Pfizer, and we want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their collaborative effort in supporting today's program, so it's really important to us. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is leader of Myeloproliferative Neoplasms Program, attending physician, leukemia service, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morrow is going to present an overview of chronic myelogenous leukemia, or CML, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, and the issue of adherence, taking your pills on schedule. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, everyone, for joining today. It's a pleasure to be here and to share some thoughts with you today with my colleagues on the call. So I'll start us off by talking about an overview of chronic myeloid leukemia, or CML. CML is a, first off, like to tell people that it's a highly treatable, potentially functionally curable type of leukemia, and one of the four main types of leukemia that patients can face, which is unique in that it was probably one of the first human cancer linked to a genetic abnormality. And that was based on the discovery of something called the Philadelphia chromosome, first identified back in 1960. A significant amount of research went into understanding and unraveling the genetics of this type of leukemia, and it's really given birth to the revolution of what I call targeted therapy. CML historically has been a chronic form of leukemia with where patients can manage for many years, but treatment advances have been so dramatic in the last decade or decade and a half that we now have seen publications that show that the lifespan of someone with CML should be normal, meaning that the disease can be treated and managed and not affect someone's normal lifespan, no matter what the decade in which it's diagnosed, which is great news. Again, back to the genetics and the basis of CML, an error occurs in the replication of blood, which allows for a translocation or exchange of genetic material as cells are dividing, which gives rise to something called the Philadelphia chromosome. This is an activation in a blood cell, and a cell that's early on in development, so it sort of drives overproduction of the blood. And it's easily detectable by a number of different tests. That is, the Philadelphia chromosome marker is easily detectable. And that is the genetic basis. When someone presents with CML, they may not know it. Many people are diagnosed without symptoms and are just recognized by having abnormal blood counts. And the typical scenario would be someone with an elevated white blood cell count. It can be quite elevated. And that, although it can seem shocking, that isn't very unusual. White blood cell count normally is between 5 and 10, and patients can be diagnosed anywhere north of that number, including into the hundreds of thousands, and not necessarily have symptoms. They may have anemia, they may have high or low platelets, which are clotting cells in the blood, and again, this genetic marker is a hallmark of the disease that can be diagnosed based on blood tests or by a bone marrow study. It's important to consider having a bone marrow at diagnosis to fully understand the scope and the stage and the nuances of this disease, because it's, again, highly treatable, curable, and we want to take our best approach. There are three phases of CML, which are called chronic, accelerated, and lymphoid amyloid blast phase. We treat them differently, and most people are diagnosed in the chronic phase, which is the earlier phase. Many people ask, is this a cancer that can spread, is there what's the importance of being diagnosed early? Many people are diagnosed when they've had CML for many weeks or months, and there, of course, is worsening symptoms and potentially some evolution of CML over time as if it's not treated. So it's important to recognize symptoms and be diagnosed and seek treatment when it's discovered. The diagnostics that we do are also important to talk about, and I think I just want to emphasize that we have very patient-friendly and accessible molecular diagnostics called PCR, or polymerase chain reaction, which helps us understand, number one, the presence of this Philadelphia chromosome marker, number two, the starting point which each patient has along this journey of response or hopefully remission and even functional cure, and it's very important for us to use at regular intervals to gauge progress. We look at what's called early molecular response, which is a blood test generally 3 months after treatment to show that the disease has gone into remission. This is above and beyond normalization of the blood counts, which generally happen during that time frame. And then within the first 12 to 18 months, we're expecting what we call a cytogenetic or bone marrow level remission and further remission that we can only detect by this molecular test called the major molecular response. So through the first 18 months of treatment, it's very common, it should be expected, where people have regular molecular testing. In many cases, additional bone marrow testing is helpful and necessary, and it needs to come at regular intervals, generally every 3 months, to gauge success and treatment success. Of course, prior to that, there's this important decision to be made with regards to what treatment to take, and I skipped over a huge chapter in this disease by saying that, well, the basis of the disease and the Philadelphia chromosome led to a profound understanding. It was then a number of major efforts in research over a long period of time to understand, could a targeted drug be effective against this Philadelphia chromosome-driven disease? And indeed, a family of drugs called tyrosine kinase inhibitors, TKIs, the first of which was imatinib, or Gleevec, and there are now four subsequent FDA-approved drugs. I'll list them now, just for reference, nilotinib, or Cisigna, defantinib, or Sprycel, bosutinib, or Bosulif, and lastly, ponatinib, or Iclusig. And these are used at different points in CML, and I'll emphasize that at presentation or diagnosis, you look carefully at either imatinib, nilotinib, or defantinib as our best treatment options, and potentially we may see an incorporation of one additional option, the fourth option, with bosutinib. Important trials are continuing to answer that question. So we have multiple treatment options, which can be confusing. What is the best drug? What would be the most successful and the safest option for each patient? And that's a careful decision that takes place between the patient and physician. Many things are taken into consideration when that decision is made. What we've learned is that imatinib is highly effective and puts the majority of patients into remission, can definitely engender a long-lasting remission, and is even the basis for our early understanding that some patients, after years of treatment and a certain amount of time in deep remission, may be able to stop the therapy with very careful observation, mostly in clinical trials to date, see an end to the treatment and remain in a stable and deep remission. Amongst the three frontline treatment options, as we say, nilotinib and defantinib offer advantages in that they can put patients into deeper and faster molecular and bone marrow level responses. There are different side effects amongst the three drugs. I think my partner, Dr. Jabbour, is going to talk a bit more about side effects and late effects. But suffice it to say that the advantages are present, and one needs to carefully consider what the risk of side effects may be and what might be the best option for each patient. One large example is there are some cardiovascular or vascular effects that can be seen with the newer TKIs above and beyond imatinib, and that's an important consideration to emphasize that knowing everything about a patient when they're diagnosed with CML, particularly their cardiovascular health, their age-appropriate cardiovascular risk, and anything that needs to be done in that setting is extremely important. And there's actually a field of what's called cardio-oncology, where cardiologists are very aware that patients diagnosed with cancer are likely to do well, and in this case may live normal lifespans. So managing what we call comorbid illnesses is extremely important. As we move through treatment, we look at landmarks of response, as I mentioned earlier, and our first pole position or stop would be at 3 months, or 3 to 6 months, and as the disease starts to go into remission as measured by molecular testing. That may be even then a point which to consider a change in the dose or a change in therapy. And a significant amount of data shows us that if the PCR level hasn't begun to drop fast enough in the first 3 to 6 months, generally about a tenfold reduction from its original starting point, that we may need to make such a change. Within a year's time, patients should experience a hundredfold reduction in the level of their leukemia as measured by PCR, or achieve what's called a cytogenetic remission. And ideally, they should have a thousandfold reduction by molecular testing, so what's called a three log reduction, or what's called a major molecular response as measured by PCR. And asking about these results and understanding how this scale of a treatment response is to be understood and to be followed is really important on the patient side, the physician side, the caregiver side, because there's immediate feedback and discussion that's necessary to say, how am I doing? What is my PCR? How am I faring? Am I on track? Have I fallen off track? And it plays into the last point I'm going to make, which is regarding adherence. To close out with regard to treatment options, and there are important additional medications to talk about, particularly in the salvage or the second or third or fourth line setting. And with here we emphasize the drugs bosutinib and ponatinib. And these drugs offer the ability to bring someone back into remission or restore remission when it's lost, to overcome mutations or changes in the leukemia that drive potential loss of response or resistance. They again offer different risks, and with the same theme of cardiovascular or vascular adverse effects with ponatinib in particular. Bosutinib perhaps doesn't have that type of risk, and it's important to look at the disease and the response that's achieved, any mutations or resistance that occur in the target of the drugs called the BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase, and the ability of each of these drugs to overcome resistance. So the treatment algorithm is fairly complicated, but with careful navigation, proper diagnosis, careful monitoring, importantly, proper choice and monitoring and proactive action if there is a missed milestone or evidence of inadequate response rather than waiting for the CML to increase or relapse, success can be at its highest level. And to leave off, I think adherence probably plays a big role. This is a marathon, as I like to say, not a sprint. You need to be on treatment for CML generally for several years before any consideration can be made of any longer-term alternatives to sustained therapy. The good news is that these are oral medications taken out of hospital, and people can generally feel well and return to a relatively normal life. That's not to say they're not without side effects, and they can be significant and can be very complicated, but in general, we're able to navigate quite easily or quite successfully with patients, and it's a teamwork between physician, family, caregivers, nurses, others, and the patient, and all of that should be there to support and foster a high degree of communication, rapid identification and discussion of side effects, which can clearly deteriorate adherence, to help support the idea that adherence is so important. And we've learned in research that missing as few as three or more doses or three or more days per month of treatment can have a significant impact on someone's likelihood of getting into remission or staying in remission. It's that important. So that needs to be the mantra. And I think I'm going to close here and turn it back over to my colleagues to carry on the discussion. And thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was really outstanding and very comprehensive. And also, Dr. Morrow has really been working in this area, really treating people with CML for many, many years. I often consider him to be a pioneer in this area. He's worked in this area before he was at Memorial Sloan Kettering. He was at Oregon Health Sciences Center. And so he really has a tremendous, vast amount of experience in this area and brings it to us today. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Elias Jabbour. Dr. Jabbour is Associate Professor, Department of Leukemia, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Jabbour is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research improves treatment options, and managing post-treatment side effects and late effects. And I actually, in introducing Dr. Jabbour, I want to say that he is very, he is listening carefully because he actually has a great deal to say about the management of post-treatment side effects and late effects and the diligence and the management. So I now turn this program over to Dr. Jabbour.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join you today. Dr. Morrow made it so easy for me to start. I will start where he ended. Essentially, we are here in a marathon, and we are here to work all together in order to improve the outcome of our patients. I can start by saying today CML has been transformed from a disease where many little bit of options were available to a status where we have many options and patients can expect to have a normal lifespan. So why we're here? We are here because of the clinical trials, because the patient being accrued in these trials. We did make significant progress via these trials. So I reiterate, the role of clinical trials are still very important in order to select the best therapy for a specific patient, to learn more about the biology of the disease and how it reacts with a specific treatment, the milestones that we need to assess. And then two main issues today we're facing are, can we stop therapy? And then the second, the safety concern, the side effects encountered on therapy. So I encourage all our patients to remain on a trial, especially if we're addressing these issues. Stopping therapy is feasible. There's more and more data being published and reported showing that this strategy is feasible. However, it remains risky, and we need to all work together in setting of clinical trials to identify patients in whom we can stop safely the treatment. Today we know that stopping therapy can be an option for patients who had been on therapy for a while and they had a good response, but still we do not know, even among these patients, some of them do relapse, and therefore it's really important to identify these patients, to treat them on a trial and try to figure it out which patient can stop therapy from those who cannot stop therapy. That is a really major concern. The second concern we have today in CML is chronic disease and patient live normal lifespan. However, we do face some safety concern. It can be minor or can be serious sometimes. And the safety concern can lead to dropping therapy, and as Dr. Moro mentioned, that can be a reason of lack of adherence and eventually disease progression. So it's really important to, when we face the safety concern, to be communicative and we share with the medical care providers about these safety concerns. And this will bring me back to the clinical trials, because CML is a rare disease, and a physician working by himself somewhere in a rural area may not have faced the safety concern that somebody working in academia would have faced. So we really like to work all together to keep the communication door open and try to figure it out whether the side effects are serious or not serious, how we can handle them. We know, for example, that there's some safety concern observed across the board with all tyrosine kinase inhibitors, while others are more specific to one therapy versus others. For example, we all know, for example, when we start somebody on therapy, we have to watch the count very carefully because the count may drop, and that typically happens the first 6 months of therapy, the first couple of months, and we should be cautious watching this blood test, the platelets, the white count, the hemoglobin dropping and improving, and we can help with the growth factors. Or we have the whole therapy sometimes, and then let the count recover and restart maybe at a lower dose. However, there are other side effects that are specific to one therapy with the other. For example, with dasatinib, we do see the pleural effusion happening, mainly in patients who have lung disorders, who have been smokers, have lung injuries. These patients are at higher risk of having fluid in a pleural space, which is the envelope of the lungs. And that can be handled by stopping therapy early on and resuming at a lower dose or giving some steroids. So for the patient or the money patient, if you're coughing, having short of the breath, or anything unusual, call us. That is specific for this drug. In contrast, with nilotinib or tasigna, we've seen vascular events or we've seen skin rashes and alopecia. These are more specific to the drug compared to dasatinib. So somebody, for example, with history of cardiovascular disorders should tell the doctor, my dad had an MI, or I had a stent placed a month ago or 2 months ago, because we know that patients with risk factors for vascular events like diabetes, hyperdyslipidemia, sudden death in the family, hypertension, all these are risk factors for vascular events on a drug. So one should be very careful when he's starting or she's starting on tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We know, for example, with ponatinib, the third generation of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, we do see more and more vascular events happening on therapy, which is the highest rate among all other TKIs. So therefore, you should inform your doctors about your previous history and keep close eyes, for example, on blood pressure. We don't check it often, and often with silent symptoms. So one should be very careful, watch the blood pressure, and have a healthy life in order to minimize these vascular events on a drug. Bosutinib can cause diarrhea sometimes, so you should we should inform the patient and should be aware of it. When I take my pills, I may have some diarrhea, they are benign, they can be solved, but we need to be aware of them. So essentially, it's a communication that goes both ways between the medical care providers and the patient in order to be informed, to select the best treatment appropriate to a patient profile. It depends on the safety concern. And keep watching very carefully, because we see at the long run, some patients may have renal failure, or some patients may have some dementia. These are very rare, but they do happen, and one should be very careful about them. So what we're doing moving forward, in order to minimize the safety concern, we're trying to optimize the schedule of the drug given. In order to minimize this safety concern, and one example I can give here, the ongoing trial assessing ponatinib at a lower dose to see whether lower dose can be as effective as 45 mg per day while minimizing safety concern. This study is ongoing, and if you know somebody with CMS who fails prior therapy, please check with your doctor about this option. The other chart assessing, for example, dasatinib at a lower dose, 50 mg, not 100 mg, and the idea is to see whether we can minimize fluid infusion. This study is ongoing. We're exploring lower dose of bosutinib as well to see whether a lower dose can minimize the risk of diarrhea. So the trials are ongoing with the aim to improve efficacy, because we can only improve efficacy by taking the drug, and therefore a safe drug will ultimately improve the efficacy, and the second, minimize the safety concern encountered, because we know clearly that our patients are taking their medicine at the long run. Still, there's some rare events that may happen. Please communicate to your doctors about them in order to address them and to keep the patient on treatment in optimal setting. So moving forward, we optimize the safety concern at the long run. They are there. They do happen. Be aware of them and have the communication with your doctor. Second, if we want to get to a point where we need to stop therapy, we need to have a treatment delivered in an optimal way to achieve the best optimal response we want, and therefore after that be able to stop therapy, again, I reiterate, in the setting of clinical trials, and hopefully in the years to come, we can identify patients in whom stopping therapy can be done in a safe way. Finally, as Dr. Moro mentioned at the beginning, it's a marathon. We're not here for one day. We're here for a journey that we can live together in it. It's positive. It's bright. But we need to keep the communication door, and we need to have this communication among the team that include the medical providers as well as the patient and their family. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro. That was very, very informative and lots of information in terms of both the importance of clinical trials and also the importance of really managing the side effects. Really, that's so critically important for everyone on this call. So and you also should be aware that you also can listen to these programs again as a replay on the internet, on the telephone, within a day or two after the program ends. So just to be aware of that in case you want to listen again to what we said, because all of this information is so important for you on your day-to-day living with CML. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is Founding Director, Cancer Support Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York, Accreditation Surveyor, American College of Surgeons, Commission on Cancer. And Dr. Fleischman actually is a long-term colleague, has spoken on many of our programs. And Dr. Fleischman is going to address the importance of treatment summaries, the benefits of follow-up care, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my great pleasure now to introduce Dr. Fleischman to turn the program over to Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you for all the participants worldwide for participating in this call. Treatment summaries in the cancer world are somewhat of a new thing. It is common in most radiation oncology centers to have a summary typed up after the treatment is over that is often sent to the other physicians or providers who are involved in care. That includes how the decision was made to have radiation therapy and exactly how many doses someone got and in what direction and those kind of technical things that are important for follow-up care. But as far as the rest of our treatment, be it surgical, medical oncology, hormonal treatments, oral treatments, that's never really been a focus of attention. But I think everybody's woken up. And we know that, especially for very specialized care, like you're hearing about today with CML, patients often travel far away from their home. They're at what we call tertiary care centers or super specialized programs, often in another city. Their primary care provider is not in the treatment system the way it would be if they were in their own hospital. And the level of expertise to figure out how to diagnose, treat, and then follow for good overall health afterwards is sometimes very removed from the people who will actually be doing it back home. So treatment summaries these days, because of the way we receive specialized care, is a real natural outcome. And it's something that in the field are being developed for all kinds of cancers, not just leukemia, but for each type of solid tumor cancer, like lung cancer, colon cancer, ovarian cancer, and every other one. And they're all somewhat different. The commonalities between treatment summaries are that it's a snapshot summary of exactly what kind of care you got. It may even talk about the diagnostic tests that were done that are important and important aspects of the pathology report at times. But it really is a focus on what kind of care you got, exactly what kind of care, which chemotherapy drugs, be they intravenous or oral, and how much you got. And then the second part would be, what is the recommended follow-up? Because until recently, in cancer medicine, we didn't have uniform sort of criteria or guidelines to follow patients over the long haul. It's a relief to think that now we have so many more people surviving their initial cancers that we do need this, and the field is working to figure out exactly the best way to do it. Sometimes too much information is not good. Not enough information is not good. Figuring out what type of information needs to be in for each type of cancer is something that we're struggling with now, but we've made a pretty good strides over the last number of years since this became an issue. Also in some treatment summaries are what kind of vigilance needs to be done, as you heard in the previous speakers, whether it's blood tests looking for genetic markers or bone marrow biopsies and aspirations, at what period of time, at what interval, and how that is scheduled over the next few months and few years. So treatment summaries are something that are being required more and more through the accreditation process, which I know about personally through the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer, who certifies about 1,500 treatment programs across the country and cover about 75% of people being treated in the United States for cancer. Each of the accredited centers each year has to be providing more and more of the patients who they're treating with a treatment summary, whether they stay in their system and it's electronically circulated to other providers in the system or by paper, given to patients and families. And the standard is that the paper isn't just given, but there's somebody who can explain exactly what it means, put it in regular English, so that everybody understands what the issues are and what they need to discuss with their primary care providers when they get back home or if they're still in the community. So treatment care summaries are really, really important. And as we've already heard, although we're talking about a blood type of cancer, leukemia, it does affect the whole body. And we want to make sure that the follow-up involves all of the other systems of the body that the previous two speakers spoke about, which is monitoring the lungs, monitoring the heart, monitoring the skin, and even monitoring something as simple as blood pressure and circulatory issues, which are the salient things that need to be checked every so often after treatment with tyrosine kinase inhibitors. inhibitor or any other treatment for leukemia or for any cancer, but especially in this situation. So having the information, having it in a form that you can bring to your providers, being somewhat familiar with it, will really help, because what we often hear from patients is and families is that, how do I know if I'm having a relapse? How often do I need to be checked? I don't like to go to be checked because it reminds me of what I've just been through, or I need to go to be checked because it reassures me that I'm still okay. So if there is a reasonable discussion between you and the medical oncologist, the leukemia oncologist, and the community medical oncologist or the primary care provider who's going to be doing the follow-up, everybody can come to a consensus and agree on exactly what needs to be done at what interval, so that everybody can sort of take a deep breath and know that they're getting the care that is really personalized to their particular cancer, their particular needs, and especially that in involves looking at other body systems, because if an individual is a long-term survivor of leukemia, how often do you need a mammogram? How often do you need a colonoscopy? And that's something that we're grappling with in the field, but again, that can be individualized based upon a lot of other factors beyond the leukemia diagnosis. Who in the family has had other types of cancers? Is it necessary to be more vigilant because you've had leukemia already? These are all questions that can be personalized and can be worked out with the treatment summary, and that's why that is so important. You know, we sometimes so much focus on the documentation and the paperwork that we often lose sight of the fact that that's just a piece of paper, but it's the discussion and the thought process and the experience of the providers giving the advice about how to do the follow-up and the intervals that testing should be done that really counts. And it's not just a piece of paper, it's the discussion and the knowledge that counts. The piece of paper is just a way of conveying that and reminding us of what needs to be done. That really leads into the other topic, which is communication. Again, all of our speakers so far have strongly emphasized the need for good communication between patients, families, and their healthcare teams, especially important in oncology. Sometimes things happen that are not related to oncology, their cancer treatment, their cancer illness at all, and we need to have attention to those sorts of things. And sometimes something, and that's somewhat scary to all of us, something small can happen, and then we think, oh, the cancer's back, or the leukemia's back, and that may or may not be so. So the best thing to do is to not sit with that, to ask questions. As the months and years go by, everybody gets more experienced in figuring out what's what and what needs attention and what doesn't. It is very common in my many years' experience of follow-up care for cancer patients where people get a really big scare right after they finish their first set of treatment, and they panic that something is happening, and they jump to the conclusion that it's their cancer right away, and that's sometimes the case, but rarely, sometimes mostly something else. And again, seeing people who know how to discern this and how to sort these things out is really, really important. But that starts with good communication, notifying your treatment team that this is something that is happening, you may be worried about, finding out what needs to be done, or if nothing needs to be done, and this is just a rite of passage and the kind of thing that people experience as they're recovering from their treatment. So I believe that covers the subject that I was supposed to speak about. Again, we'll have time for questions and comments later on. So I'll hand this over back to Dr. Magler.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. That was really outstanding and really wonderful information for people to have. And particularly, you're addressing really the communication piece and also being aware that it's important to anything that's troubling one to bring that to the attention of your healthcare team and not to assume that it's caused by one thing or the other, but to really have that discussion. So that's really important. And I would suggest that you all start preparing your questions because we do have questions very soon. And we'll explain to you how to queue up for questions. But if you have questions, you might note them down so that you'll be ready to ask them. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlund. Ms. Edlund is an oncology social worker. She's our online support group program director at Cancer Care. And Ms. Edlund is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Ms. Edlund.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional supportive services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online support groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. So please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. And I want to thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Edlund. I really appreciate your remarks and your comments about Cancer Care and the role of psychosocial support and support groups for people as well and all these services. Well, and now we have time for questions. So I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and she's going to explain to you how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. So this is your chance to really ask questions. And so we invite you to ask questions. I'm going to have Candace explain to you how to queue up the questions and explain to you how to do it. Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you so much. This is an excellent seminar. I'm a 10-year breast cancer survivor. Thank you, Caroline. My question is, I want to know from other different types of chemotherapy. I've had Adriamycin 2 months, 2 months of Taxol, 2 months of Taxol, 2 months of Cytoxan, 2.5 months of radiation about almost 10 years ago, but I'd like to know all the side effects that from other chemotherapies can cause CML. And other people maybe want to know also.
So your question, I'm sorry, Stephanie, is...
therapies, Adriamycin, Cytoxan, Taxol, can they cause CML? I have heard so many times from the doctors that you could, the other side effects can cause other cancers, and especially want to know with CML from Adriamycin, Cytoxan, Taxol, and, of course, radiation.
Okay, thank you for that question. Dr. Morrow, could you address Stephanie's question in a general way? And Stephanie, we definitely recommend you go back to treating health care team, but Dr. Morrow, could you just address this generally?
Sure. So I think it's a great question. It We know that when we treat one type of cancer, the treatment itself can potentially be linked to a second cancer. And there is, unfortunately, a risk with some of the chemotherapy medications mentioned by our question that can trigger more likely acute leukemia or pre-leukemia initial myelodysplasia. I think the heart of the question was, can CML be a cancer that you could develop having had treatment for breast cancer or other cancers? And that's exceedingly rare. There are reports in the medical literature about what's called secondary CML, but that tends not to be the case. We haven't, you know, all the answers, if you will, with regard to the genetics of leukemia, but I think CML, we have a good understanding that this is a fairly common error that, for reasons that aren't perfectly clear, takes hold and causes the disease, CML, in a small number of people. But if you went out and looked at it, you might detect that transiently this Philadelphia chromosome event happening more often than you think. Whereas the chemotherapy-related leukemias have other molecular or genetic changes that they can cause, and those are unfortunately usually linked to what's called pre-leukemia or myelodysplasia or acute myeloleukemia. But really, any leukemia can be potentially driven by prior treatment, whether it's radiation or chemotherapy. But with CML, it's still relatively uncommon.
Excellent. Dr. Fleischman, do you want to add anything to that as well? These concerns about.
Sure. This gets a bit confusing to lots of folks because a number of famous people, including one of our morning show hosts here in the United States, had a myeloproliferative disorder after her breast cancer treatment, and this was well publicized, including all of her treatment, and that often gets confused with specific types of leukemia. So again, ask a lot of questions, which is what you're doing now.
Excellent. Then we have a question from one of our online participants, and it's really about a 35-year-old, and the question is, what to expect with sort of a long-term, could you, after taking these medications for a long period of time, TKIs? So Dr. Morrow, if you could address that question.
So we know we've all mentioned that this is a marathon. So we're talking about several years of treatment, and we're very keen to look at what can be the early, the middle, and or there were potentially the late side effects. We know that treating CML does often trigger a number of side effects that can be long-lasting, including fatigue. It can affect different systems in the body that, you know, can be manifest in a number of different ways. But overcorrection of the blood is probably the most common early side effect, meaning the blood counts may drop. Being left with some degree of blood count deficiency, meaning being a little bit anemic or having a slightly lower white blood cell count or lower platelet count, not terribly uncommon. But this doesn't mean someone's in a high-quality remission and they do very well and can live a good life and a relatively normal life with that. We're more carefully trying to understand what other things can happen, and I think Dr. DeVore mentioned, that we have a question about can kidney function slightly decline in patients who, for example, have had leukemic acumen for many years. Nothing that would be potentially threatening or dangerous, although there are rare cases where it can be more serious, but we can do so well and have such high response rates that we're looking at some of these little questions. But what we know now, and is most common, is probably our concern over the fact that when we look at comparative groups of people who are treated with historical medications prior to these TKIs, prior to Gleevec, and then patients treated with Gleevec, and then patients treated with the newer drugs, that we see slightly higher rates, depending on the medication, of cardiovascular events and cardiovascular disease. And these are common problems, and they may be pre-existing, may perhaps be magnified a bit by treatment, they may be triggered by treatment, and it's really led us to take a step back to say everyone should understand what their cardiovascular health is and keep an eye on it, including simple things like blood pressure and if you have diabetes and blood sugar control, but more importantly, addressing symptoms and problems. But the good news is over the long term, we don't have any significant organ system damage or other comorbid conditions, medical problems that are going to develop as an automatic result of you being on a TKI or CML drug. Except for this question about cardiovascular toxicity, I think most everything tends to be an early side effect that counts, whether that happened or not, should be manageable, reversible, and but many questions still remain to be answered.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Candice?
And our next question comes from Tammy P. Your line is now open.
Hello. I had a question about the PCR milestones after 18 months. I've seen charts that go to 12 to 18 months, so I was wondering if the milestones change or did the charts not go any farther because the milestones stay the same? Say, you know, the 0.1% to 1% is a warning and above 1% is failure.
Dr. Morrow, can you, this is an important question. Dr. Morrow, could you address this question again? And Tammy, you'll take the statutory and health care team, but if you could address this in a general way.
Absolutely. So we have, if you imagine starting at 100%, we're looking at the CMI going to remission as kind of measured in a surrogate way by this PCR level, which generally would start around 100%, dropping but down to 10%, 1%, 0.1%, 0.01%, and then beyond. The milestones, to quickly summarize them, are that we would expect to be down one log or down to 10% at 3 months, down to two logs or down to 1% or less by 12 months, or ideally down to 0.1% in 12 months, and by 18 months down to 0.1% in all people treated. Beyond that, there are further benefits to getting deeper remissions, and if you follow the decimal point down, probably the next important milestone, which is next would be a four-log reduction, or an MR4, which is 0.01% on this scale, starting at 100%. Well, why is that important? Because that seems to be the level below which we think, if that's maintained for a period of years, patients can be considered to have their treatment stopped and be very carefully monitored. And I stress that that is still a question of research, and it requires very careful thought and patient selection and very careful set of rules that are actually now well outlined in the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, or NCCN. But the milestones do go beyond 18 months, and the remissions do generally deepen. And, you know, to be honest, many patients, depending on the laboratory, will become undetectable and fall below what is considered a deeper level of remission, a number, if you will, of below 0.003, which has been in the past called a complete molecular remission, although that's a bit of a hard definition to understand because it implies that it's absent or negative. It's really just below the level of detection in the laboratory. Suffice it to say that all those are very good, very high-quality remissions, and deep remission overall is the goal, and there are some rules, and seemingly below 0.01%, if it's sustained over a long period of time, seems to be the best place to be, although getting below 0.1%, called a major molecular remission, offers tremendous benefit for tremendous safety and very low risk to patients, and that's why that's sort of the most emphasized milestone, which is, again, an 18-month.
Thank you. And now there's a question from one of our online participants about starting a family. So can I stop TKI treatment to start a family? And what are the risks of trying to conceive a child while taking a TKI? Dr. Morrow, could you address that question?
I probably emphasize that anyone thinking about that, which is a very reasonable and rational question, I'm going to guess it's a woman who's thinking. There may be less questions regarding a man who's wanting a father, a child, or that question also requires attention. But that's tied into what I've been discussing, Dr. Jabbour discussed as well, which would be, can patients be in a deep enough remission to be safe and off their treatment? So yes, I think all women should be offered the opportunity to think about whether they can conceive and carry a pregnancy. Not surprisingly, you'd want to be in the same type of status where one might consider that woman safe to stop her treatment even if she didn't want to become pregnant. That doesn't always happen. Nature sometimes intervenes or things happen, as I've experienced many times. And there hopefully is the goal of achieving a deep enough remission where you can think about stopping treatment just based on that. And if the reason to stop is for pregnancy, it's quite different because obviously starting treatment back up can't happen immediately or as directed by any change in your response level. It's kind of stay off until someone delivers because TKIs in general are not sanctioned for use in pregnancy. They're category D, which means that they should only be used if the risk to the mother outweighs the risk to the baby. It's a classification by the FDA that says they're not really safe and they don't have any proven safety in pregnancy. So you need to talk to your health care provider and understand what the odds of success potentially staying off treatment, understand the risks of potentially committing to a longer period of time off treatment, 9 months plus. I also recommend that patients don't have a long period of trying to conceive while they're off treatment, and they very carefully, with their physician, only under their physician's guidance, plan when they can potentially continue to take their medication while they're attempting to conceive, with careful planning that if conception has occurred, then the TKI must stop, the medication must stop, because you don't want to expose a developing child to the drug. So very complicated equation, but bottom line is, yes, it's possible. It should be under the right set of circumstances. There are definitely risks involved, including, unfortunately, potential risk that if a woman becomes pregnant and wishes to carry the baby to term, and her CML is relapsing, that there's a much bigger risk wrapped around that the mom's health may be in jeopardy, and therefore caring for that child now is potentially in jeopardy. So I'm always very deliberate to sit down and talk to both parts of the couple, talk about these risks and understand, and only to proceed with caution under the right circumstances and with full understanding.
Thank you. And does any other people want to add anything to that? That's comprehensive. Thank you. Okay. Another question, it's a totally different subject now. Are there foods I should avoid while taking TKI? Dr. Marla, start with addressing that question.
Sure. There's really only one food I think that people generally mention is a problem with the TKIs across the board, and that's grapefruit. Grapefruit is star fruit. Those are unique fruits that, unfortunately, the way they're cleared by the body is similar to the way that medications are cleared. So by taking them, it slows down the metabolism of the CML toxin. I don't want anyone to get the idea that would be a great way to boost your medication levels. It's not, because it's unpredictable and it can be dangerous. So we're much better to limit and avoid an intake of those foods while you're on TKI therapy, so you know the dose you're taking is right and the level in your body is right. More medicine isn't always better, and it can be dangerous, as I said. So that's one big avoidance. The other thing, I'm just going to throw it in there because I think it's related to the same question. There is a medicine that should be put there, more than one. But one that's fairly commonly used, and even the over-the-counter versions, are things that block stomach acid and acids. Many people are on medicines that, to correct heartburn and ulcers, and those medicines often interact, not with all the medications, but many. And not surprisingly, if you change the way the medicine is absorbed, you might not get as much out of it. So it'll be the opposite problem. Otherwise, food, healthy diet, your blood's trying to regenerate, so I tell people to make sure they have good intake of folic acid, B vitamins, and that's intuitive, but just to mention the grapefruit is the one thing to avoid.
And another from our online participants, and this really has to do with what we call other health problems or comorbid health problems. So can female treatment drugs interfere with other medications that I'm taking for other health problems? And who should I speak to about making sure there aren't any bad drug interactions or problem drug interactions? So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Morales, if you could address this.
Yeah. Well, another good point to raise. So first off, pharmacy faculty, pharmacists, both at the corner drugstore, the where you get your prescriptions filled, online or phone resources, at the clinic, at the hospital. I'm proud to say Memorial Sloan Kettering, we have oncology pharmacists that are trained in just this question. Always important to look at all your medicines when you prescribe anything new on both ends. Let's say you're on treatment for CML and someone adds another medication, whether it's a heart medicine or an antibiotic or a supplement, anything, can be important because you could have a drug-drug interaction or could interact. There are many things that we look at. I'll throw a few examples out there. Medicines that are cleared by the same pathways, CML drugs can be an issue. They include cholesterol medications, antibiotics, a number of different things. Antibiotics can interact with CML drugs in that they can affect the cardiovascular electrical rhythm called what we read on the EKG called the QT, which can be an issue particularly for tachycardia. So some of medicines and certain TKIs or CML drugs have a particular interaction that we have to be careful about. Many people are concerned about analgesics, things they can easily take over the counter, Tylenol, Advil, Motrin, things like that. One lesson we learned really early on is that, for example, Tylenol, if you take too high a dose, a metabolite of it can build up in your blood, and it's metabolized by the same pathway as the TKIs, and there's a bit of a warning there. It's not that it's forbidden, and you can't use it or take it. It can be done safely. Again, the careful questioning and understanding between the patient and their physician. But overusing one drug could actually lead to side effects of it and not necessarily a problem with the TKI. So always run the list with your pharmacist, as they say. If you ever have a question, always call your healthcare professional or your practitioner or your nurse or your pharmacist to know if a new medicine is being added. Is it safe? Is it okay? I love when I get patients on my calls asking. I feel like there's that trust and that open line of communication to say, is it okay to take this? And it's an important question that was just asked.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. And Dr. Fleischman, do you want to add to that as well?
Yeah. Just one thing, that sometimes we don't always take credit for the fact that over-the-counter medicines, things that don't need a prescription, can be as equally interfering. So if any supplements, protein supplements, energy supplements, anything you take, really needs to run by your leukemia doctor, medical oncologist, because they all have access to a pharmacist who they trust who really understand what's important. So just because it doesn't come with a prescription doesn't mean it doesn't count. Too many negatives. They count, and they need to be effective.
And Evan, do you want to talk about this in terms of our support groups and discussion about having multiple health problems going on and keeping track of everything, or just keeping track of, like, take all the different medicines and things like that?
Absolutely. I think just the day-to-day logistics of, navigating sometimes several health issues, dealing with different drugs you may be taking to either for those issues or to manage the side effects, it can be a lot. And I think one of the lovely things about participating in a support group is that hearing how others manage some of those same challenges can be helpful in terms of getting sometimes good tips that you yourself can incorporate into your own life, but just also having a space to share about some of the frustrations, some of the positive moments, the layered experiences, I think, that everyone is having as they're managing the day-to-day. It's nice to have a space where that can be shared uncensored and feel that others can relate to a lot of your experience. I really think support groups are a wonderful way to connect with others who can understand and relate to what you're going through.
Such an important area. This could actually be its own particular call, because it comes up on many of our calls about just managing many health problems and navigating them. So excellent. And now there's a question I realized that one of the online participants and Dr. Maureen may have addressed this, but it's what causes CML? So is there any
I mentioned that early on, but it's an important point to emphasize. When cells are dividing, the chromosomes, which are the blueprints, are packaged. They're copied and they're packaged up and split. So one cell can make 2, makes more, 4, makes 8, 16, etc. And chromosomes 9 and 22 are unfortunately close to each other, and there's a high likelihood that they're going to recombine, meaning that the blueprint, someone's going to, one person in one cubicle is going to, of course, slip some papers into the next cubicle, and the paperwork is now mixed amongst the two chromosomes. So there's exchange between chromosomes 9 and 22, and the sequencing of the coding that's on chromosome 9 and chromosome 22 is now altered. And on chromosome 22, something that's an activator, something that allows for something that to not be controllable anymore, kind of gets it stuck on, is placed right in front of a very important gene. And the activator is BCR, and the gene that's very important in cells is ABL. So you have this peanut butter, my chocolate, peanut butter type reaction in cells. And on chromosome 22, you have this draw out of your chromosome. And so you have kind of like a light switch that's stuck on. And so the cells don't actually over replicate as much as they don't senesce or die when they're supposed to, and they don't stay in the bone marrow as long as they should. They leave, and that's how this disease develops, where the blood grows, the numbers grow, it spills out into the blood at higher numbers, into the spleen, which is where the blood can collect, and all the cells that are part of this part of the blood all have this Philadelphia chromosome abnormality and the switch that's turned on. There's still normal cells that don't. That's how CML happens.
Thank you. And now we have another question, which is actually related to an earlier question. However, I'm a male with CML taking dasatinib. My wife and I are wanting to conceive, and we are wondering about the risk of conceiving due to my taking dasatinib. So, Dr. Morrow, if you could address this one as well. This is an important question. I appreciate the online participants asking that question.
Yes. So, important thing is that men need to know is that taking these medications can affect your fertility. And it's ironic that the gentleman asked that question is on the medication, but I think they may be the most knowledge about that. So let's say a couple wants to get pregnant or a man's thinking about fathering a child and needs to know about his fertility. I think it's a simple test that can be done to check whether a man is fertile or fully fertile or, you know, diminished below what would be expected normal. So that's an important thing to know. With regards to if the man is fertile and he goes ahead and fathers a child, is there a risk of the baby because the dad was on medication or had CML? First thing to say that this isn't a disease that's transmitted genetically through bloodlines where if your dad or mom had it, you're likely to get it. At least that we know now. There may be a familial predisposition to having what are called myeloproliferative disorders, but it's not something like other illnesses where you get a copy of a gene from your parents and now you're at risk, or you get two copies and now you have a disease. That's definitely not the case for CML. And then with regards to the medicine effect for a dad, we don't think he's producing the reproductive element sperm and spermatogenesis is normal, that there shouldn't be a risk to the child. There were some very early studies in animals that it might have an effect, but it hasn't borne out. And our experience in the literature is that men who have fathered children, we don't have any particular literature to say that there is risk. Although my rule still is that any child who's on its way, that pregnancy should be managed as a higher risk pregnancy if either the mom or the dad has CML on medication or chemotherapy. For the sole benefit of taking advantage of very excellent prenatal screening and early testing that can be done to make sure the baby's healthy and the family knows, the couple knows that and can make important decisions about managing the pregnancy.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you for that question. And do any of the other speakers want to address this question? So there is another question here. Just one or two more before we conclude the call. Where do we find a CML specialist with experience? So, Dr. Morrow, that's really always the question people ask, because people on the call are from all different places, and both in the United States and internationally. And I
think there are good resources out there that highlight some of the folks that spend a lot of their time thinking about CML and that are experts there. The kind of ideas would be, cancer care is one. Carol mentioned the National CML Society is clearly another. Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. There are cancer and leukemia-focused patient advocacy groups that are probably going to help you find a center of excellence. I mean, fairly intuitively, a larger hospital, a larger center is going to hopefully have a faculty member that sees a number of cases of CML or maybe an expert in CML. But I think the other place to look would be the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. If you look at the panel of folks that talked about CML, that's another list of specialists. And there are, I can think off the top of my head of a dozen centers in the United States, and there's going to be key centers in all parts of the world where there's someone that's knowledgeable about these medications. And it takes a little bit of research. I think you can start with patient advocacy groups, other patients. In 2017, the Internet is a wonderful thing. And maybe not always the best information for each person. There's a lot of information to process, but you can usually get a good sense from talking to other people and doing some of the basic research with looking at advocacy groups and at large academic centers and looking at people's areas of expertise and knowledge. But I think we're out there and we're very eager to help, and we're not also here to demand that someone comes to just this hospital or to an expert just to that center thereafter. This is a long treatment and a marathon, and I think physicians and myself, Dr. Jabbour, all of us are wanting to participate in the care of folks with CML and help. And that's my first question I ask when I see someone in consultation: how can I help?
And in terms of internationally, would the UICC would that be a resource for people internationally? Or I know the Cancer Support Committee also is an international organization. They collaborate with us on our programs as well. But does the UICC or is there an international cancer organization that comes to mind that would be?
There's an international CML Foundation, the ICMLF, which I'm proud to be part of, which has is a resource for actually physicians that are working in different parts of the world, even especially developing parts of the world where they may not be as many advantages as we have in Europe and the U.S. There's the European Leukemia Net, the ELN, which has a CML group. And so again, with a little bit of tools, I think you can probably find someone in wherever you need to look. And there's a forum where people can actually join and ask questions at the International CML Foundation about CML treatment, and many experts have posted information there. So those are the places to look on the international front.
Okay, so we're going to add some of these resources for all of you and send them to everyone. But the International CML Foundation and the International Leukemia, the second one mentioned as well.
The European Leukemia Net, ELN.
European Leukemia Network, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Excellent. So we'll actually include that as well. So you'll have some resources, all of you. And, of course, we do often recommend, of course, for people in the United States, the National Cancer Institute. They have an 800 number. I'll give that to you at the end of the call as well. That is also a wonderful resource as well. And I want to thank, there is one other question. Sorry, late breaking, one more question. The question of managing fatigue, extreme fatigue. So I'm going to start with Dr. Morrow, and then I'll ask Dr. Fleischman, and I also ask Ms. Evelyn to just discuss this, and she's hard to get in some of the groups and things like that. And then we will conclude the call.
So we know fatigue can be a side effect of the medication, irrespective of anything else. But of course, you want to start with figuring out why it's there. Sometimes it's because someone's very early on and it's related to the leukemia. Sometimes it's because the blood counts have changed and they may be anemic. Sometimes it's because of other comorbid conditions or other health problems. One little known fact is that if you take thyroid medication and you start on one of the CML medications, you may need more of your thyroid medication because of there's a slight interaction between the CML drugs and thyroid replacement. So that a good internist or the hematologist needs to hear about symptoms and sort of make sure a good investigation is taken to what we say rule out or rule in other causes. Again, they may not be immediately fixable because someone's going into remission or still has their CML at a fairly significant burden. But in the end, many people are in remission, have good blood counts, don't have any of the other conditions, and are still fatigued. We've seen that with trials where people have stopped their medications, sometimes that can be relieved. I was part of a study where patients who switched from one drug to another, one of the significant gains was that fatigue was relieved, and where it was a significant and limiting factor. So make sure there's no other cause. Understand that it may be tied into treatment response, and therapies may not be able to change. But know that there are many different treatment options, 5 medications, and if it's altering your quality of life, it's got to be discussed, it's got to be addressed and sorted out and satisfied to someone's satisfaction, because it can be a major problem.
Dr. Fleischman, do you want to add to that?
Sure. Going back to your leukemia team is vital with that question. We tend to think about the sort of non-pharmacologic approaches to fatigue and leukemia, which includes working with people who know best, including an oncology nutritionist and a physiatrist or physical medicine rehabilitation specialist, who can guide you on what kind of activity to do, because good nutrition, good activity, good rest and sleep is the best antidote we have against fatigue and cancer so far. Things may change in the future, but especially in blood cancers, those are the 3 pillars that we stand by.
And Ms. Evan, do you want to comment on this in terms of the groups and how people discuss this?
Sure. So, of course, in addition to reaching out to the healthcare team, I think another important aspect is just connecting with peers to see what their experiences are, and having within a support group a safe space to share and discuss these questions and concerns. I think in some ways just to have echo back the fact that you are not alone in this. That's a huge part of participating in a support group. And I think that kind of camaraderie and that community can be very, very helpful, even in dealing with, these ongoing side effects.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really all been extraordinary. An amazing call today, really. Thank you so much. And I also want to thank you, all of you, who've either queued up on the phone or asked questions online. They really do enhance the program today, of course, and also allow further elaboration on topics that have great concern for each of you questions. So we are about to conclude the call. I just want to remind everyone that if you did not get to ask one of your, did not get your, one of your medical questions answered, we do recommend that, that many of you call the National Cancer Institute at their 1-800-422-6237 number, that they have information specialists there who can answer your questions. Of course, your healthcare team. And then there are a number of resources that we've given out actually during the call, at the National CML Society, the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, and we will, and the National Cancer, National Comprehensive Cancer Network, and we will be sending you those additional resources when we send you out the evaluation form, so you'll get that, so you'll have additional resources to get your questions answered, of course. And for those of you who wish to take advantage of any of the services that Cancer Care offers, in terms of speaking with one of our social workers, getting any practical or financial assistance, participating in one of our programs, or actually in one of our upcoming workshops that we're offering, or anyone who actually is wanting to join a support group, we suggest you call our number at 1-800-813-4673. And for international participants or for anyone liking preferring the website, the code is www.cancercare.org. And I do want to point out to a program that we are offering. Actually, there are two of them that may be of interest to some of you on this call today. One of them is about biosimilars, which is a new something new that's out there. So that might be something that would be of interest to some of you. And that program is happening on February 1st. And we also will be offering a program on vision and eye changes that people may be experiencing in general. And that will be coming up soon as well. So stay tuned. You can look at our registration page. Many of you have registered there for upcoming programs. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today. And most importantly, as we conclude the program today, we don't want any of you to feel that you're alone in coping with CML, with cancer. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support. We're here to help you. And we're simply a phone call away or a website away for helping all of you. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.